Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support. Welcome everyone to Brainstorm Brewery, episode 51. We're over the hill now. It's a downhill spiral into senileism. We're gonna have senior moments pretty soon coming up. I don't know about you young whippersnappers out here.
I think we ended up in senility a long time ago, and now we're just wondering why people still want our advice.
Barely holding on.
They want our advice because they want to buy some Dead Bridge chance.
Oh man, I'm telling you, I'm glad I got into those at like 250.
Yeah, what are those at now?
$4 right now, so they almost doubled. But you know, it's a pretty good card right there, and it's got
$4 without anybody playing with them yet. I think once this card sees play, I don't know.
Yeah, like you know, having tested a little more with it, I feel like I have a semi better understanding of how the card works than I do last week, and that like basically. I feel like there are going to be two in-game advantage engines for control decks, and that's going to be Sphinx's Revelation and or Deadbridge Chant. And I'm not sure if you play them both. I'm not sure if you play one or the other or which deck will be better with one or the other. But like it really functions very similarly to Sphinx's Revelation in that it's like when you cast the first one, you're going to take control of the game from there. Like as soon as you untap after casting it, you're going to get to take control of the game. And, you know, I think there's benefits and, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. So,
well, here's something I hadn't considered. I watched somebody at the pre-release, actually, you know, he was rolling dice, and he got a smite, played the smite, got it in the yard, got the smite with the Deadbridge Chant the next turn, smited another creature, ended up in the yard, and he got the smite again. So that was like, you know, he got to play the same smite three times because of the Deadbridge Chant. And I was thinking, huh, I never really considered you actually not wanting all 10 of those cards to draw them all. You could actually control what's in your yard with Deathrite Shaman and get some of those lands out of there and really increase your chance of, say, what if your entire yard were Abrupt Decay and you just kept playing Abrupt Decay and, like, getting it back? Because there's no clause on Deadbridge Chant that says you remove the stuff from the game, is there? I don't think
no,
there is.
No, that's the best part about it. I mean,
yeah, Harvest Pyre is actually ridiculous with it, I think.
Yeah,
sure,
like,
so
you could. If you just want to get one good creature back, and then, you know, you can keep getting that Harvest Pyre back to keep sculpting your hand over and over again. Like,
yeah,
there's all
like,
sorts
there's
of
a, there's
cool
a lot of utilities that the more I see it played with them, and it was absolutely bonkers and limited.
Well, I mean, like, I was playing with the card, and I guess it's not a, I don't think it's a Sphinx Revelation. It's definitely not a $30 card. It's definitely not nothing that's going to take over the format, but it's definitely a powerful card. Nonetheless, and something that people look at and discount as a, you know, 6-0 do nothing enchantment, you know, 6 mana to sit there and you don't see the value. It's kind of hard to value it. So that's why it's so cheap right now. That's why it's a good pickup to get on because there is a lot of potential for it. And like you're saying, when you thin out the graveyard with the Deathrite Shaman or say some other ways that may come out eventually, reoccurring an instant or sorcery every turn that you can control what instant or sorcery it actually is a very, very powerful effect. It's not the same as doing like, you know, a Bob where you're drawing something from the top of your card because you're kind of controlling which card you're getting back. Sure, you can be hated out with graveyard removal, like, you know, but at the same time, you can control what the game is, and it's almost like getting a creature to come into the great battlefield can be one of the worst plays you have if you have a powerful, you know, enchantment or, I mean, a powerful instant or sorcery that you want to play every turn.
Like, yeah, I mean, even just getting a Putrefy back every turn seems fine.
Well, right, like, and that seems really good. I mean, here's the thing, like, I think all that's true, and it's super powerful, and it's one of those cards where, like, every turn you have it in play, you're going to be a lot closer to winning. But because of that and how slow it is to, you know, really take over a game, like, I'm pretty sure it can only go, you know, on, like, a heavy control deck, and I just worry that Sphinx's Revelation is just always going to be better in those heavy control decks. And since they're from the same set or the same block, they're going to rotate out at the same time. So, like, that kind of concerns me for its playability, is that in a deck where you want that effect, you have to choose between one of the two, and it's pretty much always going to be Sphinx's Revelation, because then you also get Supreme Verdict. So, I don't know.
Well, Sphinx's Revelation is kind of hurt by some anti-Sphinx's cards. Maybe Sire Insanity picks up, stuff like that. Whereas Deadbridge Chant is not cold to Sire of Insanity. So if Sphinx's Revelation is the like most powerful card and people are hating it out, that means the stuff that isn't really affected by the same stuff is going to actually get better. So I think this could actually help Deadbridge Chant. So
I don't think it's fair to even compare Sphinx's Revelation to Deadbridge Chant. Like, this is not the same battle. This is
but they just serve the same role in that it's an expensive spell that, you know, you really want to like close out the game in your control.
I see that. I mean, I get you. It's just that, you know, Sphinx's Revelation can't be played in Jund, can't be played in green black. You know, it's totally different unless you're going four colors, five colors even, you know, for Jund. So yeah. It's not possible. It gives this option to different decks, and a rock style deck that wants to slow down the board and grind it out. Like I was playing with it in the spell where you destroy all, you know, permanents of X. I forgot the name of it offhand, but that's
Gaze of Granite.
Yeah, that was a very powerful card as well. That you want to play that, but then like the more you play the deck, you almost want to play with a Snapcaster, and it's just, you know.
There was someone I was talking to tonight, actually, who independently had come up with a deck, almost sounded like yours, but was running blue. And they were running it for Snapcaster, and they were running, Plasm Capture.
Plasm Capture.
To be able to, like, play a turn 4 Death Bridge off of, because they were running Liliana and Arbor Elf and stuff like that just to control the early game. And really just kind of ramping in with, like, Urban Evolution and stuff as well.
Yeah, I ended up going for... three Farseeks and then four Farseeks and then three of the Ruin Key or the Clue Stones.
Right.
And that kind of got there. I could get a turn four Death Bridge off of that. And then that worked. I think it was better than the Mono Dorks, because the Mono Dorks, you don't want to reoccur that with the Death Bridge. That's something you definitely don't want to do.
And Farseeks, I like Liliana, actually.
Yeah, no, Liliana, I got two Lilianas in there. Liliana was great in the deck.
Because you could get back the stuff you pitch. So, if you guys could tell, we have sort of decided that our pick of the week is all four of us talking about Deadbridge Chant.
Yep, you got that.
Yep,
because really, that is just the card the four of us are the most excited about in the set.
Oh, Snapcaster also helps, because if you exile, say, an instant or sorcery that you really don't want to have to reoccur again, it helps thins out the graveyard, so that can also help the deck.
Yep, it's a hell of a card. So if you got in when we said to get in, if you follow us on Twitter, we were all very publicly discussing in non-private tweets, oh my god, I bought this many, blah, blah, blah. I bought them off of eBay for this much. We just we were on this card.
Was actually the first paper card I've ever bought just for speculation reasons. It was just, you know, $250 just seems like it was insanely cheap, and you had to just jump on it. And $4, I don't know. If it's going to go up to 8, you know, we'll see. But
I think it will, actually. I think it's going to have a Sphinx's Revelation-style weekend. And I agree, it may not be as powerful as Sphinx's Revelation, but, I mean, in the right deck, it also may serve a role that Sphinx's Revelation never could fill. But I really expect the card to have, like, a $15 weekend where it just has that breakout deck and everything goes right for it, and all of a sudden people realize it's good, nobody has any copies, because... You know, that's how players are.
And one of the things that
that too.
And this is kind of divergent but related, is one of the things we talked about, some people were talking to us about today on Twitter, was that with Modern Masters coming out, you know, it's not like you have Dragon's Maze and then 3 months you have the core set and it's drafted for those 3 months. Modern Masters comes out in between that, and that'll draw a lot of attention away from Dragon's Maze, and then you'll hit the core set. And people won't be open, like, people aren't going to be opening that much Dragon's Mage. Like, the third set is already where the most expensive cards come from. And now you add in the fact that it, is going to be drafted for a month less. And, you know, it really has the makings of expensive cards down the road. So I think that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I don't know how much Modern Masters is going to, like, what's every store going to get? 6 boxes? They're going to sell 4 of them. Like, you're not going to be doing a million Modern Masters drafts at your LGS. So I wouldn't worry about it completely replacing Dragon's Maze.
But I mean, it takes
drafting 1 pack of Dragon's Maze, whereas you were drafting 3 packs of Gatecrash and 3 packs of RTR. So I think that is going to affect it way more than Modern Masters.
That's the usual third set. you know, the way it works with the third small set when it's the third set. Like, but even if Modern Masters just takes 2-3 weeks away from it, and then you hit the core set not long after that, it's just gonna, you know, be prepared for expensive cards from this, and cards that, were they in RTR, Great Crush, would not be as expensive as they would be in Dragon's Maze. So, yeah.
Very cool.
All right. So, do we want to get into... I know we've been telling people we're getting a bunch of emails in. We want to knock some of them out tonight. I don't even think we're going to be able to get to them all, but we can definitely get through some of them here.
So, let's encourage people. We want to thank everybody for sending emails, because we were moaning and complaining earlier that we never got any replies from anybody, and then all of a sudden we get a flux of replies, and almost to the point that it's too much. But we don't want to discourage anybody. We will try to get at every email. We thank you very much for your replies, you know, but maybe we could give some people some hints so that your email could get replied to a little bit better. You guys got any clues you want to tell the listeners? So
keep it concise.
Yep.
At least your question part of it. Tell us how awesome we are and take as long as you want to say that, but keep your question concise.
Yeah, if you try to make one point and try to just make that one point and just do it, you know, within a paragraph or two, you'll do a lot better than having a page and a half, which we appreciate, but at the same time, it's harder to shift through.
Yeah, we're actually getting to the point now where we, you know, like, we thought it was really cool when we got the first couple emails in, like, cool, I have a mailbag one coming up, and then all of a sudden they got to the point where we were getting, you know, a dozen a week, 2 dozen a week, and then it started building from there.
And I, really getting to the I point do read I, all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I read all of them, but at the same time, there's a lot of overlapping questions, so if your question doesn't get answered on here, you know, we may have gotten to it, we may answer it down the line, this won't be the last time we do this, but just understand that, you know, we don't have enough time to get to all of them.
Yeah, exactly, and that's it. We like you giving us all your feedback, whatever it is, feel free to email us, and don't get discouraged when or if it doesn't get right on the cast immediately, or, you know, later on, we're going to do the best we can to include everything.
So we're going to name this portion the fifth host. Is that the new thing you're doing?
Yeah. The idea being that, you know, whoever is asking us the question is being the fifth host there for, you know, the time that we're answering their question.
And I think anybody literate enough to send us an email probably knows about as much as Corbin.
You could have directed that at anybody on the cast.
Yep. I rolled a four-sided die. Goblin test pilot style.
All right, with that said, let's get to the first one, which comes from Jared at the Gathering Place in Abilene, Texas, who says, I've started listening to your show to get some financial insight for my brick and mortar store. What's the best way to get rid of slightly played cards or general bulk that we get from collection buying? I personally don't like to sell slightly played cards in my store, but I do if people don't care. Is there a good way to dump these, assuming they're standard legal, since you can't really sell slightly played on eBay? Do you all, as investors, ever consider picking up slightly played cards? And I'm sorry, I misread that. It is do y'all, not do you all. I appreciate all the free advice, and it's already helped me in-store grab cards moving up in value. So I'll go ahead and just address this first, because I'm actually looking at a collection in front of me that's full of slightly played cards where, you know, they were played without sleeves, and it's a bunch of things like Copperline Gorges, Rootbound Crags, Primeval Titans, like stuff from the last couple of years, but they've all got this tear in the back because they hadn't been played with in sleeves. And what I have done, generally the answer, I guess, is that slightly played cards trade a lot better than they sell to a dealer. So what I did is just take this binder of stuff that I'm planning to sell. I'm not planning on keeping the cards, but I traded out of it for a weekend and traded the slightly played cards at, you know, maybe a slight discount in trade, or just trading them to people who don't care because they're going to use them to play with, and got something back that is the same cash price but not played. So basically, then you're just helping yourself with when you're trying to buy list the cards.
Yeah,
the stuff. I actually don't agree with his premise that you can't sell played stuff on eBay. You just have to say what a condition it's in. I've sold stuff that's just jacked up because I said, look, this is. I'm considering this very fine condition. It's got this crease here, but you're also getting a $20 card for 12. So do you have a problem with that? There's a subsection of the people buying cards on eBay that just want the cheapest. If the card is sleeve playable and they can play with it, which is why they're buying it, they're not going to complain about it. So I actually reject the premise that you can't sell those cards on eBay. You can. If I can make one other suggestion, it would probably be people in your store might want to play repack drafts. So you could do, like, put together, you know, a rare, 3 uncommons and, 11 commons, put them in, like, a repack and just, like, do, like, a $4 draft and, you know, prize out an actual booster packs. Let them keep the jacked up cards. That's another way to get rid of them. You know, people don't have to shell out, you know, $15 or however much your store charges for a draft. I don't know. People do like that kind of thing from time to time, especially if your store doesn't have anybody with a cube that people like to draft. So that's a good way for people just dirtling around in the shop to kill a few minutes, too.
Yep. That's pretty much it.
All right. Let's get the next one then from Daniel.
Corbin, you got to read this in the Casey Kasem voice.
I will. I'll give that to you then.
I don't even know how to do that.
Let's explain who Casey Kasem is. Go ahead. That's probably actually dated a little bit.
Oh, come on. Everybody knows who Casey Kasem is.
This mail comes to us from Daniel, and he writes, "Dear Casey, do you have any tips on where someone might be able to go to research and learn what the casual staples are? Could you stop doing this weird voice and read the rest of my email in a normal voice?" Okay, fine. I'll do that, Daniel. "Currently, I find myself in one of two situations. One is that I'm not sure what to target in a binder of older cards, that the owner just simply put every rare he owns in a binder. And the second is when buying a collection, I'll typically price out rares if I'm unfamiliar with them. But once I've priced them, I don't know where exactly to have them in my binder as I try to keep casual / EDH items separated in a binder of its own. A $5 price tag doesn't indicate if it's a $5 casual or $5 competitive card. Thanks," says Daniel. Well, look like we've got about two questions here. The first one is what to target in a binder of older cards. Honestly, really, you're just going to go through buy lists, and you're going to find numbers that surprise you. You are going to see something like, Primordial Hydra, and basically every Hydra ever. You're going to look at what it's buy listing for and go, hey, that's a lot. And people aren't necessarily going to know that. So that's the kind of stuff you target, the stuff that's rotated, that people are glad to be rid of, but the casuals will eat up. So if you have in mind stuff that buy lists for more than anybody would imagine it buy lists for, that's the kind of stuff you target. I typically have about 30 or 40 cards that I target, and I even do that for standard stuff. There's 30 or 40 cards that are almost the same price on eBay as they are on TCG Player or SCG or whatever value we're trading at that weekend. And if they're the same price on eBay, I just target them. I don't care what the card is. So just go in a little bit prepared. You don't have to know the price of every card if you have about 30 or 40 cards that you target. Any Liege is good. Any, stuff like that. The Lorwyn Shadowmoor type block is just rife with great stuff. That pretty much any card from that set that's gold, you almost, or like is hybrid mana, you almost can't go wrong.
Yeah, that block is my favorite block in like recent memory for just, you know, money uncommons and such, but Zendikar's actually approaching that. It's starting to get there too. But yeah. So I guess the second part of this is, I guess, how to know which is a casual card and which is a competitive card.
Make friends with players. I guess. True. Like
pay attention to EDH.
Yeah.
Pay attention to EDH. Yep. Yeah.
There's some like general rules, I guess, in that like, you know, tribal cards are popular casually. Life gain cards are probably casually. Cards that say you can't lose the game are popular, or you win the game are popular. Yep. casually.
Double counters.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's this whole slate of these EDH cards that, you know, are popular casually. But I mean, honestly, if you don't have any idea, like, I mean, it's easier to learn what cards are worth money and then learn which cards are competitive and just assume that everything else is casual. Because as far as, you know, competitive cards go, that's a smaller pool, so it's easier to kind of learn that and then just know if anything else is worth money, it's going to be because of casual demand.
And yep. It depends on where you're trading. If you're trading at a GP, just go ask the dealer what they want you to bring them. Don't be afraid to walk up to a dealer you've never had a conversation with before, shake their hand, introduce yourself, and say, hey, what are you guys short on? What would you like me to bring you? And typically, if there is an answer to that question, they may pay you a little bit more.
Right.
So that's something else to have in mind. Like, it changes GP to GP sometimes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Next one is from PJ in New Zealand. He says, "Hi, guys. I just listened to the cast where Marcel was absent. A quick couple of Thero things that spring to mind. Saren is already a creature type, so hate to break it down to you, Corbin, but they don't even need to make them fish mutants like you said. Really enjoying the podcast, even if it's not completely relevant for me. I live in New Zealand, so buy lists are not a thing. PJ.
Yeah, I found that out too. I think this is in response to when we were talking about how hopefully there could be Merfolk in Theros, and we found out that because there's sirens and there's all kinds of crap that basically isn't a Merfolk. So, sad face.
But, you know, there were Merfolk of sorts.
Oh, man.
One Merfolk in Dragon's Maze.
I just think back to the Gavin episode and when you were talking about Merfolk and how he just evaded it so well with this.
He did a really good job.
He really did. I mean,
I'm sure he went home and like laughed for 25 minutes at our expense, but yeah. At the time his poker face was commendable.
Knew there was only four in the whole block.
In the whole block.
Wait, five and four? Yeah.
Yeah. Sad days for Corbin.
I'm actually going to take a moment here. Because I don't think it's been so long since this story was probably told that most people who listen to this probably have no idea why I'm a big Nerful fan and just assume that, you know, I just like them just cause. No, okay, there's actually a reason. And it's back when I was playing, trying to get into like, you know, competitive Magic and I was playing PTQs and playing a little more seriously. A buddy of mine was going to Star City, Kansas City, and this was in like, January of 2010, maybe. Maybe 2011. I don't know. It was like 3-4 years ago at this point.
If this story were an email, I would not read the whole thing.
Anyways, this is one. I'm going to tell the story now so that people know that I don't have to ever tell it again. But anyways, he wanted somebody to go with him. So he actually said, hey, I'll pay for your tournament entry because I was in college and broke and couldn't afford it. And I'll loan you a deck. You can have a zoo or you can have Merfolk. And I was like, I have no idea. Whatever.
He took Merfolk and he did okay. Is that the end of the story?
The story is I took Merfolk, went to the Legacy Open, played in it. I had never played Legacy before, so I was asking people all day what their cards did, including what colors their dual lands made, and was trolling my way through the tournament. I got second place, won a bunch of money, decided that, hey, I guess I like Merfolk. That's the story. I'm now never going to have to tell it again and get trolled because I knew I was going to get trolled. But
why did you have to tell it that time?
Because there have been people who actually have come up to me and said, hey, you're the Merfolk guy. Right?
There's been people that have come up to me and said, shut up, Corbin.
Okay. That's... Next email. Why don't you ask the email, Ryan?
I don't want to.
We don't have time for Ryan to learn how to read.
I know. Oh, this is a long one. Now, don't give it to Ryan. Come on now.
Yeah, don't give it to me.
All right. I'll knock this one out. Hey to everyone at the brewery. I've recently began to listen to the cast, and I find you guys very informative as well as hilarious to listen to. Like many of your listeners, I'm sure, I've started to look into Magic Finance as a way to strengthen, update, and grow my collection. I'm beginning to use some of the strategies you've talked about in order to do so. Speculating is new to me. My question may be a simple one. I was wondering how, if at all, do you guys think the reintroduction of modern staples via Modern Masters to the market will affect the price of modern playable cards from the post-Alara block, i.e. the fast lands from Scars of Mirrodin, the Zendikar fetch lands, Birthing Pod, Spellskite, etc.? If there's an effect, when do you think the best time to pick up those cards will be? I'd love to hear what you guys think, and hopefully this question is a discussable one. Regards, Ben, quotes, air quotes here, Aki Hermit, end quotes, Martinez. So I guess this question is, with Modern Masters, what do we think it will do to the cards that are not actually in Modern Masters?
I don't know that they're going to raise a lot more, like, I don't know. I think with this first Modern Masters, it's going to be more of a money grab. And I don't think a lot of the casual players who you're trying to get this modern stuff into the hands of, not necessarily casual, but the competitive players that are looking to, you know, utilize this Modern Masters to get into modern and, you know, because maybe they can't afford it otherwise. I don't know that they're going to get a good chance at getting a hold of it this time around just because I think how limited it's going to be and how many people are going to be trying to grab it up. So I don't expect there to be a huge demand or, you know, rise in demand for modern currently. But I think as the years go on and Modern Masters becomes a regular thing, similar to like a core set, like when M10 first came out, it got, you know, it was very popular because all of a sudden you had to buy the core set. And as it went on, you know, less and less people cared about core set. Now core set's back to the same status it was when 10th edition came out. And I think Modern Masters will be the same way. I don't expect it to immediately raise the prices, but I can see over the course of the next couple of years, anything that is outside of where that Modern Masters barrier is going up that year based on, you know, need because of the actual format picking up in popularity.
I think some of the stuff, if it is in Modern Masters, though, I think we'll definitely see a depression of those prices right away. Because even if all the cards end up in the hands of speculators, they're going to try to dump that stuff while it's high. So even if it takes a few weeks to disseminate Modern Masters, I still think it's going to really depress the prices, but probably not in a bad way. So if you're holding on anything that you think could get reprinted, I would be not holding on to it. Because so, worst case scenario, the price doesn't go down at all and you can just get it for what you paid for it.
So what about the stuff that isn't in Modern Masters, Jason, like the Zendikar stuff? I mean, do you think people should be picking those up? Do you think that Modern Masters is going to create more demand for those newer cards?
Yeah, it should. If, I mean, if anything, if it doesn't do it now, then it ain't going to really ever do it. This is the one chance for them to really get Modern into the masses. So if that does happen, you're going to need to get these the Zendikar fetches. You're going to need to get the fast lands, you know, Spellskites and odd stuff like that.
It's not a bad idea to have that stuff anyway. No matter what the price is, no matter what the price ends up, it's still going to trade well. Speculating isn't all selling. If you pick something up cheap and then you plan to trade it out for whatever its retail value is, you know, that stuff trades a little better, then it's good to have regardless. So I would be targeting that stuff. Like every birthing pot I see in a binder, I get. They're so cheap right now, but even if they never go up, somebody's going to need four of them because they trade out four at a time.
I do the same thing. And like some of this other stuff, like the Fastlands, Spellskite, Birthing Pod, like I think all those cards will continue to go up. The Fetchlands, I don't know how much higher they can necessarily go before you kind of hit like an actual entry barrier, since you do usually need four of whichever one and usually more than four in your deck. But like the Fastlands I think are great. All this stuff is really good until, you know, year, 2 years down the road, we get to Modern Masters 2. Then, you know, we'll have another conversation. But yeah. Okay. Set up the next email.
Ryan, you can do this one as short.
Oh, thanks. I feel honored.
I love how we decided Ryan can't read.
Where are we at here? Okay. I was bummed to hear that you guys only got two emails through the... Why is someone... Stop it. Damn it, Jason.
Jason stole the document for anybody wondering what that's about.
Okay. Let's see. Let's read this out. I was bummed to hear that you guys only got two emails thoroughly... That's definitely okay. Throughout the whole week, and no, that's not me reading terribly. The whole week. So here's number three: smiley face, penises for Ryan. Do you think that speculating and investing in uncommons would be a good start for a rookie? Any standard uncommons that you think are underrated? Keep up the great podcast and hilarious derails, Keith Williams. And thank you, Jason, for that hilarious derail.
Yeah, you're all about the D.
Oh, man. It's defense, right? I assume defense.
The question is, you know, if you're new to this, are uncommons a good place to start? What do you guys think?
It depends. I bought Experiment 1s and Boros Charms for like a quarter each. So that obviously worked out really well. Like a good uncommon can end up almost where a rare is in the short term. So definitely if you think there's any uncommon in Dragon's Maze that you think is going to get adopted well, and I would actually target foil clue stones and guild gates, because everybody with cubes and EDH and that kind of stuff wants things like that. All the utility stuff, you want that in foil, and it's the foil price is going to go up. So uncommons actually aren't that bad to target, and I've definitely speculated on uncommons myself.
My take is this. One of the easiest things to do, and you'll do this at any point in your finance career, not just when you're new, is to go through the draft leftovers on the table, and that's where you find a bunch of these uncommons. Like, you find the charms and guild mages and stuff, and I don't buy those, and very, very rarely, I guess, is the answer, like, buy them in anticipation of them going up, but I do keep them in my binder, and I do, you know, go around looking for them, because they do trade out well. And, you know, they usually trade at, you know, a dollar or whatever, even if they're below that. So it's kind of a very low risk thing. And like, I've had a lot of success keeping charms in my binder, keeping guild mages in my binder, stuff like that. So it is kind of a way, if you're new into it, to kind of build yourself some more opportunity, I guess. You're putting more opportunity in your binder by having those, because they're going to trade above their market value. But as far as just buying in cash and selling in cash, I think it's a pretty rare thing where that works out.
Except when it totally does.
I mean, yeah, like I said, it can, but Like,
but it has to be super obvious. Like, Boros Charm was super obvious. Experiment One was super obvious. Burning Tree Emissary was super obvious. I actually don't see a ton in this set that reminds me of those cards.
Right.
I mean, I think the new Recoil, well, not Recoil per se, but the bounce a card and then they sacrifice a creature. I can see that being one, but I don't actually know what the pre-sale price on that is, so I guess.
Yeah, like, they have to be very, very cheap, because it's difficult if you know, you buy a bunch of Gore Clan Rampagers or whatever, you know, when they came out, because you think that's going to be a $2 or $3 card. Or, like, I know a lot of people went deep into Despises last year because they thought it was going to be Inquisition of Kozla, like, $5. And then that doesn't happen. You can kind of be left holding the, you know, you can be in trouble there, because it's not like dealers, if an uncommon is not heavily played, they're not really hurting for them, because they get so many in bulk or in leftovers. So, like I said, it's, I think, just you have to be careful about which ones you're targeting.
Oh, and it's not like you can say, well, I'll sell these for a loss and recoup some of my investment. No, dealers won't take them at all.
Right, exactly. Okay, all right, who wants to get the next one?
I'll totally read it. Longtime listener, first time emailer. Couldn't think of anything more clever than that. I hear you. Well, not really. Just heard a few of your podcasts while starting my journey into the finance world of MTG. I was curious why a price is decreased depending on modern versus standard seasons. If a card is standard legal, isn't it also modern legal? Therefore, if people playing modern saw this card as being beneficial, wouldn't that happen when it is launched instead of after standard rotation? I'm not seeing why there's a jump suddenly months after the launch of a card. If this is the case and is jumping right away, why do you recommend on getting into modern now? What makes modern prices move just because the season's over? Just because you aren't playing in the season doesn't mean you won't be when the season is back, or does it? New guy, Tony. He referred to himself as new guy. Thanks for the email, Tony. You know what? What he has called attention to is something that we have all taken for granted as always happening, but we never really talk about why. And before he sent this email, I guess I never really thought about it. I think the short answer has got to be, like, everybody waits till the last minute.
Players are lazy.
Yeah. Or they're just not buying the stuff because they're not brewing those, because if they're playing a bunch of standard tournaments, they're not really brewing modern, so they don't even know what they're going to want.
Right. So I guess, like, the overarching answer here is just the seasons. Like, when you come up on modern season, which, you know, is the PTQ season that runs in the end of the winter and the spring, that's when people need them for PTQs. And that's when all the PTQ players say, okay, I need this card for this deck. And that's when the prices go highest. And it's also right at the beginning of modern season, kind of into the middle of it. That's when the buy prices on the cards are highest. And then as the season ends, people stop needing those cards. You know, even, like, nobody's getting more because they're not needing modern decks outside of, you know, a GP every few months or whatever. So that's the answer as to why the cards, you know, fluctuate in price throughout the year, even if, you know, their level of, you know, playability doesn't change.
Plus, people buy these cards if they're not into finance. If they're just playing, they buy the cards with their disposable income. So what are you going to do if you have $100 to spend on cards that month? Are you going to finish your deck for FNM, or are you going to buy modern cards that you'll need in a few months? Sure, it makes sense to, you know, buy ahead, but at the same time, like, if you're not going to play with those cards, why would you buy that far ahead? So the only people buying that far ahead are the people that are speculating. So that's why to get into modern now, because the opportunity is there, because no one's really thinking about it.
And the other part of it is the speculation aspect, where, like, you know, when Beck, Call, and Dragon's Bane was spoiled, people went and bought out Clawstone Curio, which is a combo piece in the Elves deck. And because there's so, like, the modern cards that are not standard have many less copies on the market than, say, a card from Return to Ravnica. So if there's a run on a card like there was Clawstone Curio, it's going to spike harder than it would, you know, were that Innistrad or Return to Ravnica. No, this card was printed 6 or 7 years ago, so there's just fewer out there in comparison to what the newer cards have, so it causes a harder spike. And that's one of the reasons why you see big spikes on modern cards even out of the season. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go.
That was everybody waiting for somebody to improve on that. And, I think what we're all thinking, pretty much. I actually really appreciated that question, because, like I said, I never thought about it. You know, it's just something that was like, well, you know, modern season's over, so the modern cards are going to go down. They'll go back up closer people get to playing them again. But I never really thought to, you know, how counterintuitive that kind of was before. So thanks for the email, Tony.
So Tobias, or how you say this?
Tobias Andrus.
So, yeah. So we have Tobias Andrus MTG on Twitter. He says, hey, if I'm unable to get any GP events or I'm unable to buy collections from people for bulk or close to bulk price, is there any way I can make some money just selling online on eBay at car stores? I find that on eBay, I only get about 80% of the retail value on average. So if I purchase something for $2 and then 2 months later it's $4 in theory, I'm only making $1.20 per card. If I sold them at $3.20, I'd be making back about 40% more than I paid. If I had been able to get the cards in bulk from trading, I'd be making a lot more. Is this typical for people in my situation? Is there something I should look out for more than anybody else who is able to trade? Thanks for keeping the show awesome. Hit me up on Twitter.
Making 40% is really good, by the way. Like, I know it's kind of a lot of work and it's a lot sexier to like quadruple up, but I mean, if you're just like reliably making 40%, that's just fine, really.
Good.
Like, if you think the card's going to go up and you go relatively deep, but I'm not buying it. When I'm speculating, I'm normally not buying stuff and it's doubling. I'm buying stuff at a quarter and it's hitting $3, and I'm have hundreds and hundreds of copies to sell on eBay for weeks. Like, I'm still selling Rocks Faith Menders that I bought, like, when was that? The Invitational? So that was a while ago that spec hit. So even if you only make 40%, that's still pretty good. You know, that's way better than my 401k is doing right now. So I realize it's a lot of work to sell it on eBay for that 40%. But you're going to hit definitely harder than a card doubling if you have a good spec. Because the best specs for me are cards that go from nothing to very high in demand.
And yeah, people, yeah.
But if you don't get one of those, you should just be happy with 40% is still an excellent return rate on a spec that, you know, doesn't blow up overnight.
Sure, because I'm doubling up essentially by buying, you know, at buy list. And I'm buying it like maybe 55% of the card's value, but then, you know, I'm losing 13% of retail to fees on eBay. So, you know, if you don't have the opportunity to buy like that, but if your specs hit that close to that, that's still, like, that 40% is not worse than I'm doing, you know, just selling on eBay. And I'm totally fine with that. Like, I love the opportunity to buy a buy list. So if you don't have that opportunity, speculating is a good way, trading is a good way, but I would actually try to snipe eBay bids too, because people spell stuff wrong or it ends at, like, you know, if you're in a different time zone and, you know, it's, you know, 3 a.m. in the United States, sometimes you can have auctions ending then that end for cheap because no one's watching them. So there's all kind of ways to get cards for less than paying 100% of retail.
Right.
And if you're making 40%, that actually doesn't really sound all that bad to me.
Right. So I guess, like, kind of the what I'm hearing from you guys is that there is no secret to just buying online. Like, just buying online can work. Even if you're not getting these bulk prices, you can make money on this, just buying and selling online, but it takes, you know, there is no secret. You have to do the work, find the deals. Is that right?
Yeah. You got to put a lot of time in, but at the same time, you know, you're putting the time in screwing around with a children's card game. You're not busting your back unpacking a truck, and I think a lot of people appreciate the opportunity to do something easy in an office chair that you enjoy doing. So it's not the worst. So just put the work in. There's really no shortcut. I think that's when people are new to finance, they kind of hear people talk about their specs, you know, like they're telling, you know, I got this huge fish type stories, like, oh, I got this great spec. When in reality, there's some grindiness to it. There's work that goes in, but it's fun. So I wouldn't try to avoid getting your knuckles dirty. Just put the work in and it'll be rewarding.
Right. Okay. So let's read the next one here from Mark. It's, hey there guys, just started listening to the podcast and I have to say the cliche response that I'm enjoying it. Well, thank you, Mark, before I read the rest of it. I work quite
apparently enjoying our podcast is a foregone conclusion. And
yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah. He says, I work quite early in the mornings and listening to your podcast helps the day go by a little quicker. All that aside, here are my questions. I've been playing since last July and have collected a good amount of cards. I've recently sold a few cards that I had 4 or 5 of, including Sublime Archangel, Clifftop Retreat, etc., on eBay. I'm not looking to make a profit, but to have the hobby at this point pay for itself or at least mitigate some of the costs. Do you think eBay is a good medium for this? buying and selling a few singles here and there, or a buy list more appropriate. The shipping cost at times seems to really be an issue, and I was just curious. Pardon my rambling. Hope you guys can help. Love the podcast. Have a good one, Mark. So this is basically the, you know, the buy list versus eBay question that, you know, I think never really goes away. And I think Jason and Ryan, who I do know eBay a lot, will agree with me that it just depends on your situation. Me personally, I buy list things just because I find it easier and quicker, and I have a lot else going on. And that's really how I got it when I was playing to get it to pay for itself, was I would just make the trades, you know, with value in mind, and then I would buy list those cards out later to play. So in my experience, you can get more on eBay, a little bit more, but it takes more work. And a lot of times, you know, just buy listing can be better. So it really depends on what that cost of your time is worth to you, in my experience.
It also very much depends on the quantity of stuff you're moving. I think if you're, you know, looking to sell $50 to $100 worth of cards a month to a buy list, or, you know, even a couple hundred, that's just the way to go. You really have to hit a threshold, I think, of at least $500 to $600 a month, at least, to make it worth moving into the realm of eBay, to make it worth saving that, you know, or making that little bit extra. Because you're right, it really is a lot of work.
Yeah, if you're making $3,000 a month on eBay, you know, like I am on a good month, then eBay's great. But if you don't have 40 hours a week to put in, you're probably just better off buy listing, because your fees are higher when you're, you know, a casual seller and you don't have, you know, top rated and power seller and all those little perks that come with really selling a ton. If you're just, you know, someone that has their eBay account and you get your 5 feedback from the cards you sold last time around, eBay's fine. I like it, but I like it for the situation I'm in. I wouldn't necessarily, it seems like more work just to make 5% more than you would buy a listing or something like that. After your higher fees and, you know, the inconvenience of all the shipping and that sort of thing. So that's something to think about. I would actually probably just buy a list of stuff. And that's as a hardcore eBayer.
Yeah. And I think the amount you're doing is a really good point, because, you know, at some point there's you have to throw a percentage and deal with the real world numbers. And, you know, 5% of $1,000 is a lot more than 5% of $50 or $100. And sure, percentage wise it's no different, but, you know, it does add up rather quickly. You know, like you said, if you're doing $1,000 a month of business on eBay, that 5%, it does more in real world terms than, you know, the 5% you lose if you're buy listing $50 in cards. So, but yeah. All right. So, who wants to take the next one?
Oh,
nobody. Okay, I'll get it.
Yeah, all right. It's all you.
I was gonna.
I fell asleep. Right. Sorry.
Hi all. I really enjoy your podcast, of course, and I listen to it every week as soon as I get my hands on it. I'm writing though because I find the active disdain for the MTGO economy by everyone on the podcast who isn't Marcel to be really annoying.
Why are you reading this one?
Yeah. Go.
This is why I'm reading it.
Why isn't Marcel reading this?
It was. Particularly obvious on your latest episode when Marcel wasn't there, but generally you guys just really dismiss it unfairly. The Moto economy is real and is in fact a lot purer than the paper economy due to infinitely lower transaction costs and information asymmetries. Anyway, I urge you all to become more interested in the Moto economy, or at the very least not pretend it's some sort of weird world that no one knows anything about and that doesn't have any importance. I'd bet a good percentage of your listeners spend more time on Moto than they do playing paper cards, and the digital economy itself accounts for something like half of WotC's Magic revenue, so it's not exactly a niche thing. Anyways, keep up the good work, and thanks for the cast.
PB. Wait, whoa. All right, well,
you know what? Right
here. There's no way that percentage can be correct.
Okay, it's irrelevant.
Wait, I'm a Moto player, but the Magic Online economy is a lot more different than paper cards, and it's more fluid and there's different fluctuations.
Yeah. Here's the deal. I'm sure the game League of Legends is a good game. Everybody really likes it. I like what I've seen of it. I'm not trashing League of Legends by not talking like I'm an expert on League of Legends, because I don't know shit about League of Legends. It's kind of the same thing about the Moto finance economy. I don't know anything about it. Like, I'm sure people can make money at it, but I'm not going to talk. No one wants my advice when I don't know a thing about it. So it's not disdain. It's not me pretending it's a weird thing that doesn't exist. It's nothing other than the fact that I'm not going to talk like I'm an expert on it, because I don't know anything about it, and nobody wants to hear me guess.
Marcel is the Moto expert, 100%.
I'm not an expert per se. I just know some things about Moto. If you want to hear an expert, we could get MTGO Ferret from Heavy Meta. He's a lot better at this.
Well, Marcel, you're being humble, but you know a lot about the Magic online economy and a hell of a lot more than the three of us put together.
Well, yeah, but this is because you guys don't deal with it. But if you really the Magic, I mean, whatever on what we talk about translates to Moto pretty well, except for a couple various little things like Snapcasters being $7 for its entire life. And various other things with rare. So there's other, and Sphinx's Revelation being like a $35 card. So there's different fluctuations in that. But all in all, whatever advice you get from Brainstorm Brewery translates to Moto pretty well.
Playability is playability. We analyze the metagame. And when stuff gets played, you know, the price goes up. That's basically where most of my specs come from, is me seeing a card that's getting adopted. It's not really picking up steam yet. And then I talk about it on the podcast. I'm like, people are playing this, but the card hasn't gone up yet. The Moto meta is not all that different, where something I say in paper is not going to translate to Moto.
It's
like,
usually actually a little ahead.
Yeah. Moto's is almost always ahead because it's people get to just do testing way easier.
Yeah.
There's tournaments all the time. It's fine.
It's the same thing in that, like, it's not that I don't want to learn Moto and that I don't think it's important. It's that I've done paper for so long. Like, there's a social aspect of it where when I'm making money by going to F&M and trading, I'm also hanging out with friends. And that doesn't happen if I'm just grinding tickets on Magic Online. And that's why the paper economy is more interesting to me than the Moto one, and which would explain why I know about the paper economy, not the Moto economy.
Yeah, I'm all done sounding like I'm apologizing, because I actually don't agree that it sounds like we're disdainful of Moto.
Yeah.
So if it's coming across to people that way, that's not true.
Well, I do sometimes we are like, Moto, we don't know anything about it, whatever. But yeah, that's just because we don't like just we just don't want to tell you wrong because we don't know anything about it. We usually let Marcel handle those because he is the person to talk to about that.
Yeah, and as much as they don't know about Moto, I don't know about paper. So you know,
it's that's just why we are such a good team. So
and then speaking of, I want to give a shout out while we're at it to Batty Studios from Heavy Meta. He did that badass play mat for us and the backs for our tokens. We're going to have those at GP Vegas. We'll post them up in the show notes or something. You guys got to see it. It's pretty amazing. So
it is, which I realized, by the way, it's like 6 weeks away now, 7 weeks. Like, it's not that far away, huh?
Oh, yeah. I'm looking
for close.
It's close enough that I really should have booked.
Yeah. All right. So let's one last email this week before we run out of time. Hello, Brew Crew. I have a question about bulk rares / uncommon / commons. What am I supposed to do with them? Nobody wants to trade for them, and stores offer horrible deals for the bulk rares. Thanks for reading, Nathan.
Take them to a GP. Go around the room. See who's paying the best on bulk rares. The most I've ever been paid for a bulk rare is 16 cents. I thought that was pretty good. If you consider 16 cents pretty bad. Yeah, Corbin, you know, you found a store that'll pay you a quarter, and you gave him too many. He doesn't pay a quarter anymore.
I know. Right.
Yes. Yeah. But if you think 16 cents on a bulk rare sounds horrible, what did you pay to get them? Like, cause they're just free money for me. I just, you know, get them out of collections. They take up space. The only other thing I could see is, some people on eBay like to make those instant collections, you know, throw a bunch of commons and uncommons and rares in there, put them in a flat rate shipping box and, you know, sell them for, you know, a pretty decent price. You'll get more than selling for bulk that way. Or find somebody who's making those and buys that stuff. I don't know.
Honestly, there's a couple other suggestions that I know have people have done, and that's one of which is to keep a box of bulk rares, and you just take it around the room with you, and you say, hey, you can put, if you put two rares in here, you can take any rare out you want, and that works great with casual players who want to look through a bunch of cards and find something for their deck at home, and it basically costs them nothing. But then you turn every bulk rare you own into two bulk rares, and you know, that's then you end up with a whole bunch more to file it out for 16 cents.
And you end up with things that are not bulk rares.
Right. You just get to pick that stuff out. So,
or you put them in a separate binder. I've seen people say, as you know, hey, I have this binder of bulk rares here. Any trade we make, you get to pick one out. Have it, you know, like, you just have to get creative with them.
Yeah, that's actually a good, if you're off by a buck in a trade, say, hey, well, here's the binder for where we're off by a buck. So I have a bunch of crap, like foreign and foil stuff that's not real expensive in there. But if you wanted to have bulk rares in there, that easily works out too.
Yeah. So I guess the answer from all of this is get creative and find what, you know, works for you with them. Because There are ways to do more with them than let them sit in your binder, but they're not, you know, immediately obvious.
And I guess, yeah, the other point is, what's wrong with 16 cents? Or even 10? What's wrong with a dime?
Corbin, he gets a whole quarter, so...
I get 20 cents to a quarter sometimes. It doesn't suck.
Yeah, but you have to live in Oklahoma, and that does suck, so there's trade-offs.
That's true. Everything comes with a price.
Yeah, it comes with tornado quakes and earth storms.
Tornado quakes, they happen.
And donkeys rubbing up on trailers.
Star basketball players injuring themselves during the playoffs.
And he does being the highlight restaurant of the state.
Let's not talk about Russell Westbrook. I was just starting to come around to not hating him.
Right, why would you hate him?
Because every time
he switched teams?
No. But it's one of these. He's one of those players where every time he touches the ball, you, especially in the last 2 minutes of a game, you just cringe. Because, you know, especially his first couple years in the league, he would make such poor decisions. He tried to 1-5 people. He'd throw up terrible shots. He'd turn it over. Like, he's a very, very good player who lets his emotions take control sometimes, and he makes poor decisions. And therefore, you know, you cringe every time he touches the ball in the last few minutes. But he's been a lot better this year. He's finally gotten better about it, and he really come a long way as a player. I was coming around, and then, you know, Patrick Beverly injured him on purpose like a jerk. So
that's cool. See, I kind of cringe every time you tell a rambling, irrelevant story on the podcast.
You asked about it. You brought it on.
I know all about cringing.
You brought it on yourself.
Speaking of cringing,
what are we talking about?
Let's cringe out the show. Let's go.
That's a segue. Thanks for joining us, everybody.
Excellent segues, as always, Marcel.
Yeah, I'm the best. I gotta get an award for this.
We're gonna put that on your play mat. I'm the best.
Send us your emails. We will read them. We may even read them on the podcast if you say something relevant.
So, yeah.
Or flatter us. That works too.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, yeah, do send us those emails. Let us know what you thought about the mailbag episode. If you like it, if you hate it, you know, or if you want. How you think we handled it. So it's the first time we've done something like this. Hopefully, you know, people
it's actually
like
the second time. You did this the last time I wasn't on the cast.
Did we? Okay, second time. Let us know what you think.
Get your facts straight next time, Corbin.
Marcel wasn't even here. He knows more about it.
I think we read a couple, but we tried to do a regular cast. This was devoted mailbag episode.
Fair enough. All right, well, next week. Later.
Yeah.
Bye!
Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.